I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Clarence Page is our guest this hour. We always like to have Clarence on the air. Actually, he's in Madison today, and in our studios in Madison, he was the keynote speaker at a diversity forum, which is going on today and tomorrow. It's titled Renewed, A Renewed Call to Action, Taking Our Diversity Work into Broader, Deeper, and More Inclusive Waters. The event is free and open to the public, and we'll let you know more about the sessions you can attend with a phone number or website or something like that. Clarence was the keynote speaker, as I said this morning. He's a syndicated columnist, the 1989 Pulitzer Prize winner for commentary, also senior member of the Chicago Tribune editorial board. He is the author most recently of Culture Warrior, Reflections on Race, Politics, and Social Change, and Showing My Color, Impolite Essays on Race and Identity. He's been inducted into the Chicago Journalism Hall of Fame and received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Association of Black Journalists. Clarence Page, always a pleasure to speak with you, sir. Hi.
Thank you, Kathleen. Great to be with you.
Yeah, nice to have you here. So how did this morning go? Were your words listened to?
It was lovely.
How was it lovely?
Well, it was lovely because I was wondering, you know, I'm always nervous about these things. I've only been doing this for about four centuries.
I know.
But I still get stage fright, and I still have a voice of doubt that says, what if they don't like me?
Oh, Clarence.
But they were just wonderful, and I'm very excited about the conference that they're having. You know, the University of Wisconsin for years has been dealing with issues of affirmative action and issues of equity and diversity, like other universities are. And there are a lot of folks here who really care a lot about making the university as inclusive as possible, and I'm all for it.
Yeah. It is interesting when you look at universities and when you look at certainly high schools in this country, how little diversity there is in the makeup of a student body. We've just gone so far from that ideal, haven't we, Clarence?
Well, that was one of the big topics, as you well might imagine, that are we defining diversity too narrowly? These days, let's face it, you say diversity, and a lot of people think that's just like a code word for black.
Right.
And the fact is, as I made the point today, affirmative action, essentially, as most of us think we know it, essentially died in 1978 with the Supreme Court's Bakke versus University of California Regents decision, which said that you cannot have racial quotas per se, but you can take race into account along with other factors. And that really paved the way for the diversity argument. We're talking here not just about blacks and whites, but Hispanic folks, Native American, Asian American, mm-hmm. Gay, lesbian, bisexual, transsexual. This sort of diversity across the board is something that enhances the educational experience, and that's just become sort of embedded in stone, you might say, as far as the university culture across the country is concerned.
Yeah, it needs to be embedded in public school culture, I think, as well, high school culture, and in lower grades,
you know,
too.
Yeah, well, you know what the dilemma with schools is? In America, when you buy your house, you buy your school.
Right.
You know,
mm-hmm.
schools, kids go to school, for the most part, according to where they live. And now that's where magnet schools come in, because they try to find incentives for diversity, bringing in kids from all over town, regardless of what neighborhood they live in. But yeah, you're right. It's still frustrating that there's only so much you can do in that regard, because as a society, we're humans and we're tribal. We tend to gravitate toward the same communities. I talked about that today, you know, that we don't want to confine ourselves to information silos, you know, where we're only talking and socializing with people who are just like us, because we're going to run into a lot of, increasingly, people who don't come from the same background as us.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to live in the America that's developing in this century, you need to know folks from a variety of backgrounds.
Absolutely. Well, what about all of these firms? There was an interesting New York Times piece I'm sure you saw recently. Many Silicon Valley firms are hiring executives to focus on diversity because women and minorities, when you look at those firms, just make up a tiny percentage of the skilled workforce.
Yeah.
But the book publishing Publishers Weekly survey looked at the employees in that field and found 89% are white, and no real change in the racial composition of the workforce since last year, even though a lot of these places have diversity committees. What's going on?
Well, you know, it's complicated. Don't you love when people say it's complicated? But the fact is, I mean, look at book publishing. How much money are you going to make fresh off the campus? And we're talking about bright kids from Ivy League schools walk into a major publishing house, and they start out as a reader, you know, reading manuscripts, mm-hmm. or a low grade editor. They might be making $15,000-$20,000, which is nothing in New York, right? And so if they aren't a trust fund baby, they're going to have a hard time making a living. A number of them are dedicated regardless. But that same thing has happened in the newspaper industry and other media that... there's become more competition now in this internet age, it's become more and more difficult to be able to encourage bright young people to come and join your company when they have a limited amount of prospects or pay advancement. And so it's it does require more of a concerted effort to really want to reach out to a diverse group of a diverse employee pool.
Did we get rid of affirmative action too early?
Well, it was. We really didn't have much choice. You might say the politics of the era. You remember that was in the 1970s, late 70s, when the Bakke decision came down, and the Supreme Court by then was partly reshaped by the Nixon era and the Ford era, and then Jimmy Carter, and now it's even more conservative. And that's a result of elections that were swinging to the right. Nowadays, maybe we're swinging back toward the left, but we still got the same old Supreme Court. So you've got the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court now, John Roberts, has said the only way to stop discriminating by race is to stop discriminating by race, meaning, you know, end taking race into account. So he's even more radical than the Bakke decision was.
What about all of these issues that have really hurt us in the soul recently? All of these, you know, shootings that have taken place from Baltimore, what happened in South Carolina. And mm-hmm. There are just so many issues concerning, you know, police and minority communities having guns, too. Many of them, there are tragic cases over and over, yes, in Milwaukee with young African Americans getting, yes, guns at 12 and 13, 14 years of age. Is this fueling an important rededication to the topic of equity and disparity and diversity?
Yeah, that came up today. And in fact, after I gave my speech and did Q&A, I engaged in a dialogue on stage with M. Adams, who folks in the area will know as an officer with a group called Freedom Inc., and another group called Young, Gifted, and Black. They're sort of like, I hope this is a fair comparison to say, they're kind of like Black Lives Matter. They're certainly affiliated with that sort of a philosophy. We talk quite a bit about the impact of mass incarceration and these issues of police conduct. The issues of body cameras and what that's done to our dialogue these days. I'm actually optimistic in terms of how, despite the tragedies, racial tragedies are not new. What is new is cameras. You know, you look at the cases that have come up, like the ones you mentioned and others. In those cases where you've got video, you don't have as much arguing as they do, like in the Michael Brown case in, mm-hmm, Ferguson, where, you know, people are still arguing about what really happened that day. Whereas these other cases, most of them now that have gotten the most attention, you've got video, so you can see whether the police conducted themselves properly or not. And that has made a big difference now with, as I'm sure you know, FBI Director Comey last week made a speech in which he said the Ferguson effect may be having an impact. In other words, police officers may be acting more shy about conducting their patrols and all because they're worried about any conduct winding up on video. But I think that's been greatly exaggerated. He hasn't got any actual data that shows that Ferguson effect exists. It's more anecdotal. that people talk. And I know police officers. I used to cover a police beat in Chicago and all. A number of them are griping about coming out of their squad cars and being surrounded by young people with video, with their cell phone cameras pointed at them. And my sense is that, hey, this is the video age, you know. A police officer doesn't have privacy when carrying on his or her official duties, and the courts have backed up the right of all of us to take video of police officers as long as we don't get in the way. And so I think, you know, that sort of issue, though, has advanced the dialogue now and given it a new sense of urgency.
Mm-hmm. I was looking at your Culture Warriors book again last night and found myself at one of your columns back in 2008, Promised Land, Are We There Yet? And you talk about black multimillionaires, Oprah Winfrey and Robert Johnson from Black Entertainment. Mm-hmm. And then you go into this story of this 24-year-old activist, and we know who he is, who's in Chicago, who's trying to make a point to a prominent black pastor that the black problems are more economic rather than racial. Can you tell us that story? And I'm wondering whether or not you think they are now, in 2015, still more economic than racial.
Yeah, it's well, I think that my personal feeling is, yeah, it is economic, but I may, since I wrote that column, I think I may have swung back in the other direction a little bit more, saying we shouldn't play race down too much, because there is there are still significant differences in perceptions and the way we relate to each other across racial lines. But I made the point today, though, that we should not give too little attention to economics, because these days now there's as big of a gap or bigger gap between haves and have-nots within the African-American community than there is between blacks and whites. That's a big difference since the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And so what about those of us who have made it, who have college degrees, who have good incomes, who are living on great neighborhoods and are following white folks to the suburbs or whatever? What about us? What role do we have insofar as building more bridges to the inner city and helping to reduce the crime rate that leads to higher incarceration rates, and also fighting the policies that lead to high incarceration rates that in turn lead to more crime and family breakdown, et cetera? So I think, no, this is the new era of questions that we have to deal with now.
Well, how do you answer that? What role do you have?
Well, I think I think it was Jesse Jackson who said nobody's going to save us for us but us. Or at least nobody's going to do more for us than we can do for ourselves. We certainly have a vested interest in the African-American community with trying to help those who are still trying to struggle through, you know, make it with good schools, get jobs. We have a terrible problem with record incarceration rates and young men getting out of jail, getting out of prison, who now have a prison record and they are not getting hired. They don't have opportunities to be self-sufficient, and they wind up going right back into dealing crack or other things in order to just get by, and they wind up right back in the system again. It's a terrible self-perpetuating type of a dilemma and predicament that we've gotten ourselves into in this society.
I was interested, and I haven't seen the whole interview. I think more of it's airing tonight. The president was being interviewed by Lester Holt on NBC last night on prison sentences for nonviolent offenders. And the president said something I wanted you to respond to, that he was happy to have been able to galvanize Americans on issues of racial disparity. Has he done that for all of us, the president?
I heard that and I thought a bit sarcastically, yeah, he's galvanized a lot of white folks against him. And I shouldn't say not all white folks, but we're talking about the kind of angry backlash that we're seeing with the Tea Party movement and other folks on the political right. And people who are, you know, middle class or working class white Americans, especially white males, who feel passed over. They feel they're getting squeezed from the top by elites who are exploiting them, and they feel that there's people below them who are getting more benefits than they are. Rightly or wrongly, a lot of these impressions are incorrect, but nevertheless, they are self-perpetuating, and they lead people to make radical choices for president and other public offices. I'm not going to mention any names, however.
You can if you want. It's okay.
Okay, well, yeah, Donald Trump and Ben Carson and Carly Fiorina. Why are the outsider candidates, the ones who've never held political office before, suddenly so popular, you know, leading the Republican ticket in some cases? A lot of it's because of Republican voters who are upset with the folks who they put trust in, who have let them down in their view, that the ever since the Reagan era, they've been voting for a certain kind of candidate, and as far as they can see, things haven't gotten appreciably better for them, and they've just become more resentful. So they, when somebody like Donald Trump comes along and is ready to shake up the whole egg cart, these folks say, "Yeah, right on, go ahead and do it." They may not have a program in mind or whatever else, but they just want to see things get shaken up.
Yeah. How do you explain, and he's ahead in the polls now, Ben Carson's incredible popularity? Why are people flocking to him?
Well, first of all, he's got an audience, just like Trump's got an audience built up in the media over the years. Carson has over 20 books, I believe, mostly about himself and his struggles, and from going from poverty to one of the world's leading neurosurgeons. He's especially popular among evangelical voters.
Uh-huh.
And in Iowa, they are very important. Remember, in past elections, Mike Huckabee, Rick Santorum, Pat Robertson won the Iowa caucuses on the Republican side. And I think that's the same group that is pumping Carson now. They might like Trump, but Trump is a little too brash for them. He's not as good of a Christian as Carson in their view. That's my my sense. Now, I have not seen this broken down by geographic areas, but I know in past elections, Western Iowa is particularly favorable toward evangelical conservatives, and that may be enough for Carson to win Iowa.
Interesting.
We'll
see. Is it a sign that Republican conservatives are embracing diversity?
Well, you know, this is a good example of how race isn't everything. You've got, look at Herman Cain 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Conservatives loved him. In previous years, they loved Alan Keyes. We need to get rid of our old ideas of racism from back in the 60s or 50s when black people were just held back because of their skin color. Now, there's a more sophisticated judgment being made about their actual beliefs that are being expressed. And if you're a black candidate who professes a rigidly conservative views, you will find a lot of support and allies in the conservative community.
Clarence Page is our guest this hour, joining us from our studios in Madison, because he is in Madison. He was the keynote speaker at a diversity forum at the University of Wisconsin-Madison today. This year's theme, a renewed call to action, taking our diversity work into broader, deeper, and more inclusive waters. It's a two-day event. It has a lot of different sessions, and there are book readings and film screenings and lectures. And if you'd like a whole breakout of sessions and things that you might be interested in what times those are happening, go to diversity.wisc.edu, and you will find it there. Clarence is the Pulitzer Prize winning journalist for commentary. He's been a columnist and a member of the Chicago Tribune's editorial board for a number of years. His column is also syndicated, and he is frequently on TV as an analyst, a fine, fine political analyst. He was the keynote speaker. We're talking about diversity and welcoming your phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we'll be with you momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Clarence Page is with us this hour. Diversity in the workforce, diversity on police forces. Is it something that we form all these committees for and then we don't really see diversity? How important is it for this country to address issues of diversity and race? And how do we go about doing that? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Clarence Page is our guest. We start with a Facebook comment. Rich in Rhinelander, Clarence, wonders if diversity is not the wake-up call that white America needs. It's the snooze button. This is a quote from Ellen Berry in a Salon article titled, "Diversity is for white people, the big lie behind a well-intended word." Rich is wondering if you'd seen this piece and might want to react to it.
Yeah, I have. And it gets back to what I was mentioning earlier, that diversity has become a code word for affirmative action in a way. I probably shouldn't say code word, but it's kind of replaced it really just as a matter of public policy, frankly. And that there are some people who want affirmative action for blacks. They want it as reparations or whatever other argument. They want it targeted for African Americans and other dispossessed groups can have their own separate arguments. I belong to the school that says we should like diversity as a general policy, not just along lines of race, but also along income, urban, rural, ethnicity, gender, politics. We are a very diverse country and increasingly diverse. And I don't think we want to. I use the example of Mitt Romney's campaign today, who ran an excellent campaign for winning white males, which he won. He won a majority of white male voters and married women, and he lost every other group because of just neglect. He just, I don't know, tunnel vision or information silo, whatever you want to call it. And I see the Republicans moving in that same direction now. We'll see what happens. But these days, you know, there aren't as many white voters as there were in Ronald Reagan's day.
Yeah.
Something like about 11% fewer. I forget the exact numbers, but a substantially smaller group of white voters, and getting smaller. And white voters are expected to be a minority by the early 2050s, is it? That's the kind of America that we're moving toward, increasingly diverse. And we need to frame ourselves to deal with that. It's really more for the younger people, younger than me. I'm not going to live to see it. But, but you know, my son is in his 20s, and these young millennials, this is all second nature to them. I mean, we had young people today, including the young person who was in the dialogue with me today. This is all second nature to them. You know, as I said to the young lady today, you know, this is your century. I'm just lucky to be walking around in it.
We're lucky to have you walking around in it.
I can't remember
who said this recently. Maybe you'll remember. You know, we had this huge debate, the Republicans did, after Mitt Romney lost, that, well, what's going to happen now is that the Republicans simply have to devise a strategy to appeal to African Americans and to Latinos because they can't win if they don't. And so little has happened. Somebody said recently on the show that if we don't start doing that Texas could fall to a Democratic presidential candidate fairly soon.
Right.
And then you would never see another Republican president unless the party reaches out to minorities. Why don't they, Clarence?
Well, you can see that the RNC, the Republican National Committee, headed by Reince Priebus, the chairman, they have done quite a bit of outreach. But look what happened this weekend. You see the Republican candidates for president who have pulled away from the RNC because they're upset with the way the last debate was conducted. Mm-hmm. And so they went off on their own to negotiate with the networks for their own debate. And they don't seem to care 2 or 3 cents for what the RNC has to say. I'm talking about Donald Trump and Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, not as radical as the others, but more so than Jeb Bush. In any case, they're right now, we're falling back into the old pattern of reaching out to the most conservative Republican base voters because they're in the primaries, in the caucuses, and they want to win those primaries. But they're getting out so far to the right, I have my doubts they'll be able to pull back toward the middle well enough a year from now to be contenders against whoever the Democratic candidate might be. I expect it to be Hillary Clinton right now. You know, I said on your show before that Jeb Bush would be the strongest candidate for reaching out to the middle. And I think Marco Rubio is more and more showing potential in that area. It's one thing to say, yeah, we need more diversity. Another thing to get people to really care enough about it to really do it. The candidates right now see that, well, of course, the other thing is older people vote more than young people do. Homeowners vote more than non-homeowners. There's a certain profile of voters who are more conservative and tend to vote more than others. And that is what the Republicans are stuck in right now, that they don't want to lose their old base as they try to reach out to a new one.
Yeah. Well, let's look at Marco Rubio and Ben Carson, the most diverse of the number of people. I don't know how many it is anymore, 15 who are running on the Republican side.
It's hard to keep count, isn't it?
I know. It really is. Would Marco Rubio attract a sizable number of Hispanic and minority voters? Would Ben Carson attract a sizable number of African-American and Hispanic voters?
I think Marco Rubio has reached out to Hispanics more than Ben Carson has. But more than Ben Carson reached out to African Americans. But Ben Carson has been out to some African American campaign stops, and he does have a lot of goodwill out in the community. I mean, I first met Ben Carson when he came to my son's school back in grade school, and Ben Carson has been out for years talking to students and pitching his books and pitching his success story and calling on folks to be more self-sufficient. And it's, you know, good, nice, warm-hearted homilies. What I've noticed as a campaigner is he doesn't know much about the Constitution or the laws. He did an interview with NPR Marketplace that was embarrassing. And his now he was asked about the debt ceiling. Would you raise the debt ceiling? And it's quite apparent. You listen to the interview online, and you can hear he doesn't know what the debt ceiling is. I think it was Kai Rizdahl interviewed him, and he repeated it, and he said debt ceiling, but Carson kept talking about the debt, which is a whole different thing. You know, the debt ceiling is to pay off that which has already been voted for by Congress. If you don't pay that off, then the government goes into default, and which we've never done before. But Carson didn't seem to be aware of that. He's been a busy man being a surgeon all these years. He doesn't know much about politics and the government, finance, and all that. That's forgivable. But to run for president, that's an awkward situation for him to be in. So we'll see what happens here once again.
Can you believe his mother was one of 23 children? Every time I read that, I think, really? How could anybody have 23 children?
Well, my Aunt Bessie had
not
23. She had about 17
she did.
Kids.
But, oh, my goodness.
You know, my family is from Alabama, rural Alabama, and especially in the earlier, before the baby boomer or even during it, they had large families on the farms and all that. And I'm trying to think. I think Mike Tyson had a big family too, like that. But in any case, it wasn't that unusual. But what's remarkable, though, about Carson is that he cut himself out of the herd, you might say, and really made something of himself over the years.
Yeah, he certainly did.
It's an admirable story.
Let's look at where there are all these, you know, we started talking about all these, you know, universities and the entertainment industry in Silicon Valley putting together all of these diversity committees, and then we don't see very many results as a result of people paying attention to the very issue that you've been addressing at this conference. Are there any industries that you can think of that have formed these kinds of committees, Clarence, to great success, that the workforce has become more inclusive?
There are some, and I'm sorry I can't list them off for you right now, but they are. But there are organizations that do keep track of this sort of thing and give out awards for making great progress in diversity. I remember IBM was really good, and Xerox, they were really good in this area for many years. And I'm not up to date on the current figures, but I know that Silicon Valley has been under a lot of pressure in recent years to become more diverse, not only external pressure from Jesse Jackson and other folks, and like Al Gore's on the board at Apple, he's been pushing them, but also internally, because if you want to run a high-tech company, you need to be really open to talent from all over the world. And I was invited out to speak at an AT&T location a few years ago, and I thought I walked into the United Nations in that auditorium, because there were people from literally all over the world, Africa, South Asia, just all around, because, you know, America still is an attractive place to come, especially if you've got some skills. And in the high tech industries, these occupations are so much in demand that they have a lot of diversity. But they also have to be aware of how do you make a hospitable workplace for diversity. It doesn't do you any good to hire non-whites or hire more women and promote them, but they don't feel comfortable in the place where they're working. They feel isolated and alienated. That's not good.
Right. What about in the entertainment industry? We had the first African-American woman to win the Best Actress in a Drama Series Emmy, and she had some very poignant and pointed remarks when she accepted this. Everybody said, this is great. You know, I think Hollywood likes to pat itself on the back sometimes and say, look, we're way ahead of the rest of the country. But when you look at that industry, it is still very much white-dominated. Is that an industry that can make a difference, Clarence?
Yes, it's not just white, but male.
Right.
There's only one woman's gotten best director so far, and that sort of thing. Although there are more and more women directors and very good ones. It's funny when you get into a field like Hollywood, which is a very arcane, tightly knit community where people feel very independent-minded about themselves, and they feel like they know what's best. It's very hard to get them to take good advice from outside. But you know what really makes the difference there? I've found over the years, you know, you take somebody like Spike Lee. He wasn't given much respect until his movie started making lots of money.
Right.
You know, much more money than they cost.
Yeah.
And the studios began to give him, began to green light his more and more of his projects until he got carte blanche eventually. And that's the way that dog-eat-dog world tends to work. I've learned better than to believe the stereotypes that Hollywood is nothing but a big haven for liberals, like, you know, Wall Street is all conservatives. Life's a little more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm. Our phone number, if you want to join our conversation with Clarence Page, we're kind of all over the place, but that's in a good way. That's what happens because there's so much you can talk about with Clarence. Clarence was the keynote speaker this morning at Important Diversity Conference and the University of Wisconsin campus in Madison. It's a two-day fall diversity forum, and they're looking at all kinds of issues, lots of different breakout sessions, and there are films, and they're looking at issues of race and violence and creating inclusive workplaces and inclusive universities. And Clarence addressed this issue as the keynote speaker and then also was on a panel, an open discussion on intergenerational community activism, racial justice, and social advocacy with the co-executive director of Freedom, Inc., who also is working with young, gifted, and black. So what do you think? Do we need diversity committees to look at these issues of diversity and race in light of what's been happening with police in minority communities all over the country and all that's happened as a result of that? Has the term become so meaningless that it doesn't mean anything except, as one person once wrote, as a code for black people to a profit imperative? Is it important to have these? What do we do? What do we do to make our whole society more inclusive? Clarence is, of course, a syndicated columnist. He won the Pulitzer Prize for commentary. He's on TV analyzing politics and is a voice worth listening to whenever he's on, which will be a whole lot during this presidential year. And if you want to talk about the Republicans reaching out to minority communities and if they'll have to survive, Ben Carson's appeal, Marco Rubio's appeal, would it behoove the Republicans to nominate one of those two to get more people from those communities to vote, because they, in the last election, had the white male vote pretty much tied up? We would like to hear from you. 800-486-8655 is our number. And we'll be with you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Clarence, starting with Tom in Minocqua. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Colleen and Clarence. Two questions, one about Governor Walker, and one about the debate expectations that the Republicans have established. It doesn't seem feasible that legitimate news organizations would abide by the requirements that they've established, does it? It just seems beyond propriety for them to accept these requirements.
Yeah, I haven't looked at all the requirements. They've come up with their wish list already?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll have to look, because this is not new, ladies and gentlemen. Every election, the networks negotiate with the campaigns, because Democrat or Republican, the campaigns want the show to be their show. And so they want to be able to tell, the size of the podium, the length of the program, et cetera, the whole format and all that. And so they negotiate back and forth. So that's why you don't see the networks standing forth with great indignation and resisting all this. They're saying we can work it out. But I have not seen what their final wish list is. I'm sure all of them, to get a chance, Donald Trump would like to have a large Trump sign at the back of the stage, I'm sure, and they could go on and on. But I think they're going to work it out one way or the other here, and we will see another debate on NBC. It won't be quite as ragged as that last little fiasco was.
And, of course, while they present it as news, it really is a money-making venture for the networks, too, isn't it?
Well, surprise, surprise, we news people are in the business of, we're not in the business of selling news. We're in the business of selling you, the viewer, the audience, selling the audience to advertisers. So that means, you want to build up as big of an audience as you can, because you're going to make money from the advertisers the bigger the audience is. So that, too, is not new. And we also need to remember that debates aren't old of a tradition. They really got started. Well, actually, Lincoln never debated the presidential race. Lincoln and Douglas debated in
before.
A Senate race.
Yeah.
They never debated for the presidency. And you didn't have presidential debates until Nixon and Kennedy back in 1960, in the early TV era. And it's been a TV show ever since.
And is it really worth continuing? Are they valuable? Maybe we shouldn't even have these kinds of debates,
or whatever you
want to call them. They're not really debates.
Well, what do you think? Do you find them interesting?
I find them interesting as entertainment. I'm not sure I find them interesting as a helpful guide as a voter.
Mm-hmm. Well, they seem to turn elections, depending on what happens. JFK, for that matter, was struggling against Nixon until after Americans saw them side by side. JFK was so confident and cool. Nixon was so famously ruffled looking. He wasn't feeling well, and you could really see it. People who heard it on the radio, as the legend goes, thought that Nixon won. Those who watched it on TV thought Kennedy won. Every election cycle, we hear stories of this sort. There are certain turning points, like what Ronald Reagan saying, I paid for this microphone, various other famous zingers that have occurred in these debates over the years. So, yeah, they're entertaining, but also, as a TV era journalist, I have to say we all are trying to keep the audience interest, and you don't want to make it a clown show. But it's no sin to be entertaining as long as you're not distorting the news. In that sense, I'm not that troubled by the way the debates go on. I enjoy watching them, and they've certainly gotten really great ratings with Donald Trump.
Unbelievably.
Yeah.
And it's on cable, too, which is amazing. You've got 14 million people.
Yeah, we know what happens here is that when I worked in TV full-time back in the early 80s, I remember my news director said, you can't beat entertainment with news, meaning if your news show is up against a popular entertainment show on another channel, you're going to lose. Just prepare for that. And that's still true. What has happened now, Donald Trump is already an entertainment celebrity. And to a certain degree, so is Ben Carson, as I mentioned earlier, with a different demographic of voters out there. But these are folks who will draw an audience of millions just to see them and what they're going to say next. And so that will pump up your ratings. And, you know, we have mixed feelings, I tell you, in legitimate newsrooms, because we want to build up audience, too. And we do know that when we've got a Donald Trump story, it's going to get readership.
Right.
And that's why you see Donald Trump in the paper every day, just about.
Well, it gets too much of him, don't you think? I mean, I watch MSNBC occasionally, and every time he was given a speech when he was at the top a few months ago, they'd cut into commentary and other news and give us another Donald Trump speech. And I'm thinking, do you really need to do this?
Oh, it's so shameless. I mean, really.
It is shameless.
You know, I mean, let's face it. When the public stops tuning in, then we in the media will stop tuning in, too. But as long as we know that there are a lot of people out there who want to see what shenanigans Trump gets into next. You know, I was saying all along, is this a reality show? You remember on that last debate, Trump was asked, is this, he said something about, are you some kind of entertainment show or something like that? And I've been thinking this all along, because he's already a reality star with his, his entrepreneur show.
The Apprentice.
Thank you. Yeah. I don't know. I'm drawing a blank on the
My
Apprentice.
Favorite, Clarence.
Yeah. I liked the first season. I thought it was great, but it got repetitious after that. But a lot of other people like it. But it's off the air now. And Trump was looking for something new, and he found the presidency, I think. I don't know.
Thanks, Tom, very much for your call.
Yeah,
is it Stigma in Madison?
Yeah.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that the Republicans may never have another president if they don't finally pay more attention to minorities. Mitt Romney's father and grandfather were both born in Mexico. Anderson Cooper spoke to his relatives in Mexico who were very proud of him. He was never allowed to mention it. And Jeb Bush's wife is Mexican Indian, so his children, by definition, are all minorities, and he speaks fluent Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
They say he was a very good governor, and governors are best trained for the presidency because they're CEOs. But the Republicans hardly talk about them. They're mostly mad that he is too liberal. And I'm also grateful to President Obama that he's finally addressing our horrendous prison population. We have more than any other country on earth, and we are bankrupting this country. It's costing us billions every single year, and again, hardly anyone mentions that.
Thank you, Stigma.
I'm glad you mentioned it, yeah, because this is very true. And it is costing so much money, in fact, that now we're finding in the heart of conservative territory a rising movement against mass incarceration. The Koch brothers in particular, and a number of other folks, even Ted Cruz and Rand Paul. You've got a number of conservatives. Grover Norquist's been a leader in this. I've talked with him several times about this because they see it as being thoroughly inefficient and ruining lives is costing way too much money, and it's not doing anything to reduce crime. And those are good reasons not to pursue this policy. And you actually have cases like in Texas under the Tea Party and the NAACP working together on this issue. I mean, this is what's happening now, finally. It took a lot of tragedy for us to get to this point, but I hope some change will happen.
What's happening to Jeb Bush? And do you think that it would be politically advantageous for him to talk more about the diversity in his family, Clarence?
I think he has decided it's not advantageous right now because he is reaching out to the Republican base, and that is a base that right now has turned sadly xenophobic and doesn't want to hear about programs that let more Hispanics or other immigrants into the country, or they don't want to hear about growing diversity. There's a lot of diversity anxiety in the Republican base among people who think that they're losing their America, quote-unquote. And they want to roll things back, like my friend Pat Buchanan, who seems to feel that the country's been going downhill ever since Elvis hit the Ed Sullivan Show. And there's that sense that the culture is just falling apart, blah, blah, blah. And so Jeb is staying away from that right now. I think this is his strategy. And if he can get the nomination, you're going to see his diverse family out there all over the place.
Right.
But so far he hasn't. But the problem with Jeb is he hasn't found anything that clicks with the voters
right now.
And it's just a remarkably poor campaign.
Do you think he has a chance? It's funny because it was a given not very long ago that he was the anointed one, as Hillary was.
That's right. Well, one thing that people didn't figure on, including me, is the tremendous anti-establishment sentiment that's risen in the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
They are, as I mentioned earlier, they don't like Reince Priebus and the RNC, and that's their central network organization. But they like the Tea Party better. They like this renegade movement better, and they like the renegade candidates like Trump and Carson. And the question is, I mean, there are no actual votes that have been cast yet. We have to remember this.
Right.
And so I'm still eagerly waiting to see what are the voters actually going to do. There's still enough time for people to change their minds.
Yeah, absolutely.
Still in November.
Yeah.
And the first votes aren't – well, the first caucus isn't until February. Things can change. But Trump has already lasted far longer than anybody expected, and I think it's really rather unprecedented to have lasted this long in the polls to be the kind of outsider candidate that he is.
Yeah. Sigma, thank you. Pam in Madison, hi.
Hi. This has more to do with Hollywood than politics. HBO has a series called Project Greenlight where Ben Affleck and Matt Damon put up money for a young filmmaker to be able to make a film with HBO. And from the beginning, that series pairs a young film writer with producers who then help him make the movie. The woman who was his main partner, producing partner, was black. And it was a very clear picture of male white privilege in Hollywood. Any time that she would bring up, how do we get people of diversity in there, even Matt Damon said, well, we have to make sure we make the best movie. And at times she was being vigilant about who was being cast, saying, if we're not going to have a diverse cast, if we have any minority actors, let's just make sure they're not servants. She found the one black person in the cast who turned out to be a driver, and they finally substituted that out. And in the shooting of the film, it was clear that the black people they employed in the making of the movie were essentially the blue-collar jobs on the set, and that all the privileged white boys, the Matt Damon and the director and everybody else, were just Peter Farrelly, are all just, you know, happy Hollywood white boys congratulating themselves on a job well done.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, I have not seen the show. I've heard about it, and hearing you talk about it makes me want to go see it. I'm gonna go in and watch it on demand or something. I'd heard about this, and it sounded to me like Matt Damon took a lot of heat for his tone deafness to what the young woman was talking about, because she was talking about the importance of diversity in the movie production,
mm-hmm.
and he was saying we just want to make the best movie right now, regardless of what color people are. Well, that's a wonderful sentiment. We hear it all the time in media work. We've in various newsrooms. Everybody's got their horror story to tell about arguments over this sort of thing. And I think it's great that they're putting it on national television so people can see this play out, because I think we may all find this to be a learning experience. But this is an example of what I was saying before, that once you have diversity, you've got to have a hospitable environment to maintain diversity.
Yes, and they not create that at all on this movie, and it's a perfect example. Ultimately, the poster for this series with this particular movie producer, I'm blanking on his name, Matt something, he ended up picking all white men to stand with him for the poster. The woman who was his producing partner was nowhere to be found.
Ooh.
Wow. Talk about tone deaf, huh?
Yeah.
It is ugly. It was just ugly.
Mm. Yeah. And it's amazing, you know, how people would just... they won't see what they're doing. You know, they won't step outside and say, you know, how does this look to the world?
Right.
It just doesn't dawn on them until suddenly they're getting all kinds of heat from their audience.
Lack of awareness.
Yeah.
So in the minute that remains, what did you learn at Madison today, Clarence?
Well, it was interesting talking with young people because their attitudes are... I was saying to the young lady from the... M. Adams from Freedom Inc. When she was talking about African Americans need to be able to consolidate their power better. We still don't have enough power. I said, you know, it's like deja vu all over again. When I was your age, I didn't say that. I didn't say when I was your age, but I did say when I was in college back in the 60s. You know, Black Power rose up, and you had the book with Stokely Carmichael and Charles B. Hamilton, and I thought Black Power was a slogan in search of a movement and a strategy. Never really developed one, but it was the same goal, though, saying, you know, we need to empower ourselves more. And I think that, you know, both the old and the young need to talk more about how do you empower yourself, especially for those of us who know something about media. Everybody has a TV studio in their pocket called a cell phone. It's got the ability for you to be able to go out and shoot video and do the kind of things that took a whole TV network to do in the olden days. And so, you know, the world is changing. And these young people, they know how to handle media and get their message out. And so I like to help them to focus more on how to deliver an effective message, while they help me to focus more on what an old fogey I am.
You're not that old, Clarence.
Yeah. Well, I am a fogey.
No, you're not even that.
Even when I was a young fogey, I was.
Thank you so much for being with us. It's always a great pleasure. Have fun this year.
You too, Kathleen. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks. Clarence Page, speaking keynote speaker at the Diversity Forum at UW-Madison today. His most recent book is Culture Warrior, Reflections on Race, Politics, and Social Change. And he's author of Showing My Color, Impolite Essays on Race and Identity. And, of course, you see him as a commentator on politics frequently these days. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the show. Thanks to Scotty Myers as well. And thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 1 o'clock, and great conversations are ahead.